chapter 7 and 8.
Yeah.
We are about to finish the story being told to the children. So the story within a story, which we had the last, it was last chapter, last two chapters, I forget. It's gone on for a while. We have, so the children understand that hundreds of years or an untold amount of time have passed. What they used to know of Narnia is now ruins and woods that are far overgrown. And they have been listening to a dwarf that they rescued tell the tale of Prince Caspian, who he is, where he's come from, over the generations of different King Caspians, including the one who conquered what is now being referred to as Old Narnia and Old Narnians. Mm-hmm. Who give some examples of Old Narnians.
Talking trees.
What else? Naiads, dryads,
centaurs, the
talking animals, yeah. All the cool parts of Narnia that we knew from the first book have seemingly disappeared for so long that the only thing that remains are vague superstitions about things like the woods are full of ghosts and that the sea is treacherous and dangerous. The Telmarines, who conquered the old Narnians generations and generations and generations ago. King Caspian the First is the conqueror. Prince Caspian is Caspian the Tenth, so it's been a good long time. That the memory even of old Narnia has been suppressed. And very, very few know anything about it. And what they do know sounds more like fairy tales than reality. So we hear all about Prince Caspian and how he's raised. Who is the king right now?
Miraz.
And Miraz is the king, and he is Caspian's
uncle.
Then why is he the king and not Caspian?
He's a usurper.
But Caspian was very young.
Yeah. Caspian was young. Miraz murders his own brother to assume the throne. First as a Lord Protector until Caspian comes of age, but then he even gets rid of the other nobles until the court is filled with no one but Miraz supporters who declare Miraz not to be Lord Protector but king in actuality. Well, even though Miraz isn't like Caspian, he treats him sort of like an adoptive son who will one day gain the throne. What happens?
His wife has a baby,
and it's a little boy, which means what for Caspian?
He is out.
And what does it mean for Miraz to want him out? That's right. That means dead. This is not send him away or send him to his room. This is, I murdered your dad, and I'll murder you. So how has Caspian escaped this terrible fate?
Dr. Cornelius,
who is in actuality not a man but a half-dwarf. The refuge dwarfs that were able to intermingle and intermarry generations ago. So there's a little bit of dwarf blood still in this very learned man, Caspian's tutor, who teaches him the real history of Narnia and who helps Caspian escape. Once they realize that he is about to be murdered because of the birth of an heir. Cornelius wants them to split up and run off in their own ways. He gives Caspian, you know, food and water and gets him on his horse, and he gives him one other thing.
The horn
of Susan, the greatest treasure of Narnia that over a lifetime of looking Dr. Cornelius has managed to find somehow, the horn that promises if you blow it, help will come. So Caspian sets off. What happens to him?
He gets in a terrible storm.
Storm.
And he gets knocked off.
Knocked off.
And unconscious.
Unconscious.
And he's woke up by animals.
Okay. So he meets three people through that, you know, keep coming. Regains consciousness again. We meet them, a black dwarf named Nicabrick, a red dwarf named Trumpkin, and a badger named Trufflehunter. And last class I talked about those three, not just as characters, but also as archetypes. that Truffle Hunter was the faithful one. He's a true believer. He believes in Old Narnia. He believes in Aslan. He is the one who treats Caspian with the greatest respect. The one who seems to have a moral code that, like an animal, I simply am what I am, and I can do no other. He is a badger, and he is steadfast. Nicabric, the black dwarf, he's more like an anarchist. His hatred of Myraz and the Telmarines who have conquered Narnia is so sharp and so extreme, he is willing to do anything and everything. He just wants them dead. He wants them gone. He's the one who seems most likely to kill Caspian, and he's the grumbliest one of them all. But he's also willing to join Caspian. Why?
To his advantage.
To his advantage. If you can help me destroy Myraz, I'll work with you. Okay. He is willing to do anything and everything to achieve his goals. His goals are completely single-minded. Now in the middle, we have Trumpkin, the Red Dwarf. And I argue that Trumpkin's sort of a pragmatist. He identifies himself as being just sort of a moderate middle ground. I don't fall too far in one direction or another. Both of you, Truffle Hunter and Nicabric, I see as kind of extremists. You both believe things that I think are silly. I just want stuff that's useful and makes sense. We follow that so far? And so these different archetypes will play out throughout the rest of the story, but I wanted us to see early on that we're not only learning about them as characters, who they are, and they've each got personalities, and they've each got little histories that are associated, but they also are pointing to different types of people, different types of personalities, even different types of Christians. If there is an ongoing parallel between the story of Prince Caspian and things like either the Babylonian captivity of the Jews or persecution of the early Christians who were hiding in catacombs or killed for their faith, that in those three, Truffle Hunter, Trumpkin, and Nicabric, you're seeing those three responses. A faithful remnant in Truffle Hunter that will remain loyal and steadfast no matter what. You have on the far side a Nicabric who is so eaten by thoughts of revenge that nothing else seems to matter, including stuff like faith. Whatever will get me my revenge is what I believe in. And then a pragmatist in the middle who kind of says, well, all this sort of seems a little fanciful to me. I'm about what makes sense and what works. You follow? Okay.
I just had a brain something.
Yeah.
Where did the humans come from after the kids left?
Yeah. So, as explained by Dr. Cornelius, the Telmarines, in their histories, say we've always been here. But that's not true. There was a land beyond the mountains called Telmar, where they came from. So these men cross over into Narnia as an army, and they subdue and defeat whoever's here.
They were there even when the kids were there.
But we don't know that.
No, they were
we don't know that. But somewhere in the time that's passed, you know, between when the children were in Narnia and the hundreds and hundreds of years until present time, that so the children are in Narnia for maybe 10, 15, 20 years. Long enough to grow into mature adulthood.
Yes.
And then when they cross back into England, boom, they're instantly children exactly the moment they left.
But they came in contact with no humans. They were the
correct. They were the only ones.
Some of them, some.
Exactly.
Right.
And that was a big deal.
Right.
You know, that's the White Witch had been waiting for any humans.
Right.
So the first we hear of Telmar, Telmarines, other humans is by finding out that at some period of time, after the four children go back to England, in the hundreds of years that pass, and what we could assume is relative peace in Narnia, eventually other humans show up and conquer them. All we know so far is what Dr. Cornelius has told, that they have come from this other land.
Wasn't Caspian the first, the one that came and conquered?
Yeah.
He's named Caspian the First. King Caspian, or Caspian the Conqueror. That doesn't mean he's the first Telmar man. It just means that he leads an army over. William the Conqueror leads his armies from Normandy into England, and he is proclaimed King William the First, or William the Conqueror. So it's the same kind of thing. They have now been spreading the word that through Caspian they have a potential heir to the throne, and one who is estranged, violently estranged from Myraz. Someone that the old Narnians could potentially rally behind. And so they go from place to place and they meet a bunch of people trying to organize a get-together. There's a decision is made, it ought to be a council of war, which is a little bit surprising, but okay, why not? And he meets the underground. There's all sorts of talking animals and mythical creatures that still exist, way more than he ever would have imagined.
And that's where you think of the catacombs, really. I mean, because they're in caves underneath the sacred stone there.
Yeah. Right. Well, yeah, I mean, I think when we get to it in just a second, the catacomb imagery is going to be very, very clear. So, that's going to bring us to Chapter 7, Old Narnian in Danger. So all these old Narnians that have come together and started talking about, we need to organize. They now start to do that. On Dancing Lawn, where they were last night, they start gathering together, and there's all sorts of animals, even ones that we hadn't met for the first chapter. So who are some newcomers to the party?
The
bulgy bears are back.
Moles,
more mice.
A giant.
Wimbleweather the giant. Those first couple of pages I find really funny because I have been to meetings like this where you can pick out the personalities and who's going to say what. There's always the one elderly statesman who wants to give an address, like the raven. There's always the person who wants to have lunch first, like the bulgy bears. Patter Twig, the squirrel, and just wants to do everything at once, and just you're so excited to be there. They are trying to kind of, in this cacophony of the animals displaying the character, their essential character. That's a neat way that he has done this. That rabbits, though they are talking rabbits, though they are intelligent, though they are self-aware, they're still rabbits. And the same thing with mice. There's something about how each of them act that is true to their animal nature. So before they can really get organized, what happens?
That's it. Start to smell a man.
There's a man nearby.
Smell him.
Yeah.
Everybody's, what's up? But it's a man, but not quite a man. Something's funny about it.
Yeah.
So what does one of the black dwarfs immediately volunteer to do?
So,
shoot it. I'm going to kill it.
Yeah.
And cast, no, capture it. So, once again, we're starting to see a little bit of the character. These black dwarves are kind of rough around the edges, and they have no qualms about shooting first and asking questions later. But Caspian wants this creature captured. Good thing, because it is
Dr. Cornelius.
Dr. Cornelius. How is Dr. Cornelius welcomed into the group?
There was some trepidation, but Caspian says...
Yeah? Mm-hmm. And I would say some hostility.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. What is he referred to as by some of the other dwarves? Some of the pure
renegade.
A renegade. He's a half-breed. He's, when we were out there suffering, your family took the easy way out. But he's welcomed in. It's not his fault what happened generations ago. And ultimately, it's Caspian's decision. Caspian loves and respects Dr. Cornelius, and so he will be welcomed in to the group. Let's see. Where else? Dr. Cornelius has come with some troubling news. What is the troubling news?
The army's on the move.
The army, Myraz's army, is coming. Why?
The horse
didn't know any better, but it wanders back to the castle, and they put two and two together.
Yeah.
This Caspian's horse is here. He's saddled and he has stuff, but Caspian is missing.
Yeah.
So they put two and two together, which wasn't very difficult to do, to say Caspian has run off. We're going to go get him.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Why do they want to get Caspian?
To kill him
and to make sure that what's happening now cannot happen. That there will not be an alternative army, there will not be an opposing force, there's not going to be another claimant to the throne. We need to deal with this and eliminate him. So he's come not just sending scouts, he has come with an army. Alright, so... again, the different animals all have a different take on what to do next.
Yes.
Who wants to stand and fight? The mice, by golly.
Yeah.
These mice, man, they are something. They're the littlest ones there. Dr. Cornelius makes an early joke about grasshoppers, but they are valiant. These mice are fierce and determined. They are courtly and mannered. These are, when you see them described, especially Reef-a-Cheep the leader, as we've met before, even the way that he's dressed, like a cavalier or like a musketeer, you know, very, 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 very proper with a rapier. And I mean, little slight things. You know, it may sort of make sense that a mice isn't going to use like an axe or something, but they, even the tools that they use are sort of intuitive to their animal natures. But the mice are like, let's fight! Some of the other animals want to run. The bulgy bears want to eat. Finally, it's Dr. Cornelius again, who's kind of the learned counsel of the group, comes up with the idea that they all agree to. Where do they head to next?
Go east down the river to the Great Woods.
Aslan's house. Okay. They all figure out, okay, this is a good idea. It's a defensible position. You can be hidden within its tunnels. Even if the army comes, there's only the one way. It's obvious in and out. And, you know, anything less than a siege that starves us out, we would be okay. And so it seems to be very smart.
And the Telemarines hate that area.
They hate the area. It's by the Great Woods. It's by the ocean. It's by all sorts of stuff that they're not going to like. So this is the wisest course of action. Everyone seems okay with it. Trumpkin's view is what? He's going to do it. I mean, he's real clear about obedience and loyalty, but you recall what his thinking is as they leave for Aslan's Howl?
He didn't want to go back through the woods.
He wasn't crazy about the idea, but again, he's Mr. Practical. He is the pragmatist. He basically says, I wish you guys would stop thinking so much about fairy tales and more about food and armaments and... The practical things that we need. If we're going to be an army, armies have to eat. Armies have to have tools. Armies have to have swords. You keep wanting to talk about Aslan and Peter and all these fanciful things. I wish you would think more about real life. But off they go. And they make it to Aslan's Howl. So let's describe Aslan's Howl.
The writing is on the wall. There are markings on the wall.
Mm-hmm.
Around the green hill, it's the table.
Another hill, a big stone table, a huge
round. Okay, so what's deep at the center of the howl? The stone table. The stone table upon which Aslan was killed.
Yeah.
Okay. So when you think of Aslan's howl, and howl is an old English word for like a burial mound.
I didn't understand that.
That's the hill part of it. So over the centuries, things have been built up and around the stone table. Can you liken that to anything in our world?
The growth of Christianity.
The growth of Christianity, growth of the church. I think that's part of it. Anybody ever been to Israel?
No.
Anyone ever seen pictures of the holy sites in Israel? Okay. They build churches over stuff. And some of those churches, they get bigger and bigger and bigger. They've been built onto over the centuries. It's shrines and all sorts of stuff. You know, you can go to, for instance, Bethlehem and go to the place where, you know, oh, this is the cave or whatever. I mean, there's just stuff everywhere. Shrine of the Holy Sepulchre, okay, this is, you know, where the tomb is, you know, stuff all over the place. It's not just the place, the spot where something important has happened within Scripture and our faith, but it's now been built around it as a memorial, as a testament. Throughout the Old Testament, as a matter of fact, when important things happened, you know, a battle or a blessing or whatever, time after time after time, you know what they do? They build something. They name the place, and they make some kind of marker so that the generations to come may remember what happened here.
It started way back with marking with a stone.
Right. A lot of place names in the Old Testament have some sort of origin where, you know, something happened, like we just had this a few weeks ago with Jacob's Ladder, and Jacob has this vision, and he lays some stones to memorialize it and calls it Beth-El, House of God. So that, you know, you put up a sign, and signs will weather and decay, but you make a big tower of stones, and the idea is, you know, I will show my children one day, and they will show their children, and so on and so forth, and this amazing thing that happened will not be forgotten. Because even when we start to forget, somebody will see that stack of stones and say, hey, what's that stack of stones for? Oh, yeah, that's where Jacob, you know, blah, 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 blah. Okay? Favorite place name in the Old Testament? Favorite place name in the Old Testament? Gibeath Haraloth. Okay? So on the far side of the Jordan, to cross the Jordan and into the Promised Land, as Joshua is about to lead the children of Israel, you know, from the last step of the wilderness and back into Cana, they realize that all of these men who have grown up over the 40 years have not been circumcised.
Oh my God!
So before they cross over, there's this little line, and it says, "And all the men were all circumcised, and they rested while they healed." And they named the place Gibeath Haraloth, which means Hill of Foreskins.
Oh,
really?
Wow.
So, that's one to grow on.
I'm certainly glad you shared that.
Indeed. You're welcome. All right. So, anyway. Is there a holier place in all of Narnia than the stone table?
No.
Absolutely not. No. I mean, that is, it is the greatest of tragedies, and it is the greatest of triumphs. And so over the generations, all of these things have grown around it to signify how holy and how precious. And now they're actually, you know, to talk about the catacombs and the hiding of the Christians, what were catacombs used for?
Worship.
Primarily.
Protection.
Primarily.
Burial.
Burial.
That's right, there are lots of niches in
that. That's where they put dead bodies, or that's where they put skeletons. In, it was honorable, but they had these underground places. It's like a cemetery. And so cemeteries, and they're very holy, and they're very, you know, put apart. But they became a refuge and shelter for the living, who had to find a place to hide. And where do they hide? But they hid amongst the dead. And in essence, that's kind of what's happening here. Aslan's Hal. Even the name evokes a burial place or death, but they are finding it at their sort of, they're finding with it Aslan's Hal their temporal salvation. You know, they find a defensible place, a safe place. They are safe amongst the dead. Make sense so far? Okay, so. So they find a good place, but guess what? The army has found them. And is it a small army or a big army?
Big army.
Way bigger than they expected. And they are stuck. So they start off with a strategy of kind of these little...
forays.
Yeah. Sorties, we might call them. Where you send out smaller groups to just kind of annoy. You do little things. And there was even a battle plan drawn up that they thought... they could kind of do some real damage, and what happened?
Giant.
Yeah, no one reminded him that giants aren't very bright. And he went the wrong way, and he went at the wrong time, and they were exposed, and pretty much everybody got beaten up. And Myraz's army suffered basically not at all, but now everyone they're in jeopardy. They're hurt, they're wounded. Some more than others, they're just miserable. And they are...
especially the giant.
Who's miserable because he knows it's his fault. He might be dumb, but he's not stupid. So they are just... they're kind of at their lowest point. Where... I liken it a little bit, you know, never been in war. But there are... let's say a big project. Let's say these awful bathrooms. When you start off, it's very exciting. And your mind is full of possibilities about how great it's going to be when you're done, you can see the sequence of events. Well, first I'm going to do this, and then I'm going to do this, and I'm going to do this. But there always comes a moment in the middle where everything has gone wrong, you are sick and tired of doing it, you still feel like the end result is a million miles away, and you hate it. I hate this project.
Yeah. Why did it so, ever start it?
Yeah, now, but you're too far in to turn around. Right. You're stuck. So that's the most miserable part.
Yeah.
The old Narnians can't say, hey, time out, Myraz. Let's go back a month and pretend like this never happened.
Yeah.
They are now in it, and there's no way out other than through it. But any excitement or any dreams that, you know, we'll take the fight to Myraz and we'll retake Narnia.
Right.
The cold reality is what?
They're ready to be defeated.
Yeah,
we're gonna lose.
Yeah, they are outnumbered, they are outclassed, and they are trapped. So, what is the thought now?
To use the horn.
Use the horn.
Use the horn.
It's a good time to
and there's a little bit of debate about it.
Yeah, because there's one says, how do you know anybody's going to come?
Right. Well, and there's even that, and I'm bad about this. Like, but what if it's more important later?
It's worse.
You know,
yeah.
Yeah,
you need it later.
I'm really bad about gift cards. You know, somebody gives me a gift card for like, oh, thank you very much, but I don't use it because I keep thinking, I'll use it next time. I'm gonna really wish I had this. So I don't want to spend it right now because
there's
always going to be another one, and that's the one I'm really going to need it. And the very sensible advice is, look, if you don't do it now, there may not be a second chance.
Yeah, that's right.
Mm-hmm. That's right. So what's the practicality of blowing this horn?
Practicality, I think it's going to summon Aslan.
Maybe?
They
okay. What are the what are the thoughts about when we blow this horn, what's going to happen?
Well, the
help is going to come. What are the options? We
maybe
think it could
the
be
the great king.
The great kings. It could be Peter. It could be the high king Peter and his consort.
Yeah. Yeah.
It could be Aslan.
Yeah.
You
could scare them.
It could summon them right exactly where they are, or where else, what else could happen?
Well, they decided that there might be a better place.
Okay, it could summon them somewhere else. We can't assume that it's going to happen right here. What are the two most logical places to cover as far as summoning help?
Mouth of the river.
And the
river
where the castle was.
Yeah.
Okay.
And
so Cair Paravel on the sea.
Something called Lantern Waste.
Lantern Waste. What does that make you think of? Lantern Waste.
Where the world children first appeared.
First of all, waste, in this sense, just means like nothing. Like empty forest or a place that's very far away.
It's that
lamppost for the first wood.
Yeah.
So they say that's where the children first appeared.
Yeah, they say
by the lamppost. So that whole area, which is now considered way out in the sticks, way out in the boonies, they call Lantern Waste.
Okay.
So, lantern because of the lamppost. So, we've got two options here that we think, you know, the help, if it doesn't come right here, then it's probably going to come to one of these two very, very special places in Narnian history. So we need to send somebody, right, to bring them back. So who goes to Lantern Waste?
One of the squirrels.
Pattertwig the squirrel. He can go from tree to
tree.
Even though it's a further distance, he's probably going to be safe because as a squirrel, he can travel without ever setting foot on the ground.
Yeah.
That leaves someone to go to Cair Paravel at the mouth of the sea, just in case Aslan comes from over the sea or the High King comes back to his castle. Nobody wants to do it. Who finally says?
Trumpkin
does. And his whole thing is like, I don't believe this at all. But I've said my piece, you're my king, you tell me to go, and that's what I'm going to do. So even as the pragmatist, he's faithful in his own way. And maybe working through this process, he's starting to really kind of connect to Caspian and his kingship and all that sort of stuff. And so Trumpkin volunteers to go to Cair Paravel. He takes a risk, and he is caught. And for whatever reason, the little castle chieftain who catches him wants to have a grand execution rather than just killing him. And so he sends his soldiers to drown him in the haunted river. Which means, at the end of the day, how do all the pieces come together?
That he's the dwarf telling the story.
Trumpkin is the dwarf who's been telling the story. Okay? So Trumpkin the pragmatist, Trumpkin who met Caspian first, Trumpkin himself is the one who has been there with the children, who Susan saved, and has been telling this entire story, really firsthand.
But was that in the book?
Mm-hmm.
All of a sudden, they're just telling about it. I mean, they didn't tell. It wasn't in the book as far as it actually happening, where she got saved. I missed that.
Yes. Yes, it did. When they found out where they were and they had retrieved their gifts from the treasure room, they were trying to figure out how to get off the island, and they see a pair of soldiers in a boat.
Yeah.
They've got a bundle that's kicking and struggling, and they realize that these guys are going to try to drown whatever's in that bundle. Susan shoots an arrow, clocks the guy in the helmet. They run off screaming, and they rescue the dwarf.
What chapter is that?
Maybe three.
Beginning.
Eight?
Two or three.
Oh, two
it's
or
early
three.
On.
Okay.
Yeah, it's really
well,
early
my memory.
Right.
I'll,
it's very early
it
on.
I forget
say his name is Trumpkin.
That's right.
Okay.
They only identify him as a dwarf. He
dwarf.
Is very clearly... a dwarf, but the kids, they never introduce themselves formally to him, and he never introduces himself formally to them. Because they've saved his life, they're real happy.
Yes.
They catch some fish for breakfast.
Yes, I remember.
And then he says, well, one of us needs to tell a story. I'll go first.
Yes,
and so these last couple of chapters have been Trumpkin telling a story.
That's
and now the puzzle pieces have connected, and we realize that it is Trumpkin all this time, whom they have saved and has been telling the story. So, that leads us to this next chapter where Trumpkin is saying that he heard the horn, this unmistakable sound. And the kids think
that's what summons them from the
village.
Yes.
And they try to they sort of put two and two together about the time of day and the morning and all that kind of stuff. And it was Susan's horn that has called them.
Yeah.
So
I thought it was funny that Trumpkin was he was running or something. Anyway, he took a shortcut and got caught.
Right, and that's why that's how he gets caught, that's how he's taken to the river, that's how they will eventually save him, and that's how he's able to tell this whole story. The children, once they realize what's happened, that Susan's own horn has called them out of England into Narnia, it sort of makes sense in a fairy tale sort of way. And they talk about the djinns, who we might think of as genies. And they basically say, it's sort of weird to think about you being the genie who has to come whenever they're summoned. Like, we've seen that in stories. You rub the lamp, and the genie appears. That's all well and good. But what happens when you're the genie? You know, you're in the middle of doing your dishes, and you get, you know, yanked out of the lamp, whatever it is. So they're kind of piecing this together and sort of thinking through. It's just sort of a funny feeling. What is Trumpkin's assessment of the situation?
He doesn't see the kids as help.
Exactly. He says, well, I guess I better head back to Caspian and tell them that nobody has come.
Yeah,
right.
And what do the children think about that? Pardon me? Excuse me? Here we are.
Yeah.
Hi, King Peter. We're all here. The group's all here. Yeah. And what is Trumpkin's response to that?
Your children.
You are the four children.
Yeah.
How do they Oh, that's just
right.
Super. They're there. My dear little friends. We're all very fond of children. Of course we are. But we really kind of needed help and not somebody to babysit. And how well does that go over to the to the kings and queens of Narnia?
Not well.
Edmund
has a
mother.
They have a child.
So how do the kids figure out how to convince Trumpkin that they are indeed the help that has been summoned?
They're going to demonstrate their capabilities.
That's right. Yes. So the first thing they do is they sort of sucker Trumpkin into a sword match.
Yeah.
Who's the sword match with?
Edmund.
Why Edmund and not Peter? Peter's the oldest,
Edmund,
he's the high king.
If I don't do well, then it won't look bad.
Yeah, it's a calculated risk.
Yeah, yeah.
He said, like, I'm the number two guy, I'm not the number one guy.
Yeah.
So if I fail, you know, just in case, then we can always say, well, I was the number two guy.
Yeah.
And if I beat him, all the better because
yeah.
I'm the number two guy.
Yeah, right.
And so Trumpkin kind of thinks they're playing around, but they go at it in earnest. And what happens?
Edmund wins.
Four medals.
Oh, this is for realsies.
Yeah.
And Trumpkin's like, oh, come on, son. Are you sure? Because these swords are sharp. And, you know, Edmund sort of humors him because Trumpkin doesn't realize. This isn't just some 11 or 12-year-old boy.
He is one of the kings.
He is King Edmund the Just.
And he has a sword.
Now they even... Mm-hmm. No, Edmund has no sword, no gifted sword. It's just a sword.
What I found interesting was, I don't know where exactly, but it says that because they have been in Narnia for a certain amount of time, they've been breathing the air of Narnia.
That's right. He said if they had had this duel 24 hours before, what would have happened?
He would have lost.
So Trumpkin, who is a mature adult dwarf with mature adult dwarf strength and a lifetime of skill and everything else, against, say, a 12-year-old boy, should have kicked his butt.
Yeah.
But
and he would have if Edmund had come straight off of the train platform as a 12-year-old boy.
But he pointed something out too, that the Trumpkin was short.
Short,
and Edmund would be stooping.
Well, he's still stooping over.
Yeah, poor Edmund. He's
but,
stooping all the time.
You know, there's something about adult strength and kid strength, and that, you know, kids can, you know, run and jump and do all sorts of stuff forever, but there's just something about bodily strength that's different. It's maybe just how we know how to use it differently. I will liken it to playing basketball games against teenagers. They are now taller and faster and can jump higher than I can. But I'm able to still push them around. Even some of these boys who seem, but they're lifting weights and stuff. There's just something about the...
They don't know how to use their strength.
They don't know how yet, maybe, but the maturity of strength.
The stamina is not quite
So anyway, he's no longer just a 12-year-old boy. The heir of Narnia has been working on him, and it says his hands have now remembered their old skill. Okay, it's not so much magically transforming him as he's kind of getting it all back. You ever been in a situation where you go back to a place you haven't been to in a long time and you sort of feel differently? Like going back to a hometown, going back to an old school, going back to an old place of work.
I just did that last year and went back home.
Okay. And did you feel a little different?
Yeah. Things weren't as big as I thought
they were. Yeah, suddenly they seem kind of small. So all of a sudden...
And I lived there as an adult.
All of the skill that he earned as an adult, you know, 10, 15, 20 years in Narnia as a king, it all starts to come back to Edmund. And what does Edmund do? Does he win?
Yeah.
He disarms him. He beats him. Now, what's Trumpkin's response to that? Oh, you mighty, mighty warrior, I believe you.
No.
You learned a trick I didn't learn. And that can happen to anybody.
Yeah.
It's a trick.
It's a trick.
Remember, he's the pragmatist. He's the realist. He wants stuff that makes sense. And so he's got an explanation for why this boy... I mean, what's the true explanation for why Edmund, an ostensibly 12-year-old boy, could beat him, a seasoned warrior? What's the real explanation?
I think that he used his sword in a way that the dwarf was not accustomed to.
But the real explanation is that this is King Edmund. This is a guy who's fought not only as many battles as Trumpkin has, he's fought more battles than Trumpkin has. He is a mighty, experienced warrior. You just don't see that.
Trumpkin doesn't see it.
Even though that's the answer, he's not willing to believe it because it doesn't make sense to him. So he has to come up with a different explanation. What's the different explanation?
He says, you know a trick I never
It's just
learned.
A trick. You learned a little something that I've never seen, and that can happen to anybody. Think back to the first book. We have Lucy saying there's a world in a wardrobe, and Edmund was there, and he can vouch for me. And Edmund saying, no, we were playing make-believe, and she is not telling the truth. And so they have to go to the professor, and the professor uses logic. And he says, which of them would you have expected to be more truthful? Well, Lucy, obviously. I mean, Edmund's a little stinker. And Lucy always tells the truth no matter what.
Yeah.
Well, then why don't you believe her about this magical world? Well, because it doesn't make any sense. Well, sensible or not, it's true. And it's the most reasonable and most logical answer based off of these facts. So it's the same thing now with Trumpkin.
Yeah.
The most logical reason is these kids have told me they are the kings and queens of old Narnia. And they're going to be of great help. Because the horn has summoned them. But he has to come up with a rational excuse, which is
there's a trick.
Okay? So what happens next?
Can I go back one? Because wasn't the sword that he is using the gift from Jolly Old St. Nick, or...
Is it?
No, he didn't get anything.
No, he does.
Is
he using Peter's sword? Is what you're asking? I mean, maybe he's using Peter's sword. I don't recall that.
It doesn't say that.
I don't remember.
Edmund didn't.
They are all three guys.
Edmund
didn't. Yeah, Edmund has no gift of his own.
Edmund has no gift of his own.
But it,
no.
I mean, it's possible that he took Peter's sword. I just don't
Peter
remember.
Peter got the sword.
Peter had the
sword. Edmund didn't get the sword.
Okay, that's not Peter's sword that he's using.
I don't
think
so.
The dwarf
with
a
sword.
With a sword.
Right.
Yeah, there was a whole.
Okay. Yeah, yeah. Actually, says they a sword and shield were found for Edmund and a bow for Lucy.
Yeah.
Peter and Susan were, of course, carrying their gifts.
Yeah.
So it's just a sword.
A sword.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
All right.
Peter
so
suggests a shooting match.
Aha! That's the next step.
Yeah.
First, you fight my brother with a sword match, and you lose. Now, why don't you? Why don't I have a bow and arrow contest against Susan?
Yeah. Right.
And what's Trumpkin's response to that?
That's fine.
Oh,
yeah.
Right. Now, he already knows that she's a good shot. Because of the soldier issue.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But he's kind of chuckling on the inside. Why?
Because he thinks he's so good.
Because he's a very, he's known as a good shot. He is known as a good shot. So they don't realize who they're talking to. So I might have, you know, gotten tricked in the sword fighting, but you can't trick a bow shot.
Right.
You can either shoot or you can't. And so, how does the bow shooting contest go?
Well, she picks out an apple that's almost hidden. He had one that was inside.
Right.
Yes.
He's
much higher.
Already he's thinking, oh, crud. You want that one? That doesn't look like an apple. That looks like a cherry.
Yeah.
And you know, he thought they were going to a closer target, but it turned out that she was very comfortable with a much, much further away target. So Trumpkin shoots. And what does he do?
He goes over.
Just barely misses. It's a good shot.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a good, from the distance they're talking about, it's an excellent shot. What does Susan do?
Gets it.
She gets it. Right in the
middle. Is she happy about that?
Well,
She's a softy.
She's
a softy. She doesn't want anyone to feel hurt or disappointed.
Yeah.
We're all winners here, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But Trumpkin is kind of crestfallen. And it's starting to sink into him. Something's going on. And what tips him over the edge?
Well, I guess he admits that he's had an injury.
Okay, he admits he has an injury.
And Lucy said, oh, show me.
Yeah, show me.
All right, so now even the pragmatist, the realist, gives up.
Yeah,
right. You know, you're great swordsmen, you're great archers, and now you can even heal and fine, you win, I believe. And I think he's honest and sincere about this. This is the great thing about Trumpkin as a character. He is a pragmatist, or at least he starts off that way, with only the stuff that makes sense, only the practical. I'm not going to go overboard in one direction or another. But when it's demonstrated to him, he is an honest pragmatist. Because when it's demonstrated absolutely positively, then he accepts it. Absolutely.
I wonder if that was
and
like
positively.
Thomas when he was a doubting.
Maybe so. Maybe so. I think that's an excellent sort of connection there. A doubting Thomas who, when he sees the resurrected Christ, my Lord and my God, it's a beautiful, very powerful response. So Trumpkin becomes, I think, a true believer and a true ally, but he had to kind of get there in his own way, which was a little long way around. But if he was a skeptic, he was an honest skeptic. What would a dishonest skeptic have done?
Made excuses.
More excuses.
Yeah.
It's another trick. It's another this. It's another that. If you had to, could you come up with more boring, everyday explanations for each of these things? I think we could. You know, I think we could come up with, it was a lucky shot by Susan, and there was wind at the same time. And the medicine was actually,
that's tougher.
But it is tougher. but whatever it is, he is an honest enough skeptic that when his skepticism is answered, he accepts. And so that's kind of where we wrap up with now Trumpkin, the DLF, as the children now call him, which means
dear little friend.
They're not going to let him forget. They're not going to let him forget that he called them dear little friends early on, little children.
Like BFF.
Mm-hmm. So, what is now? They're going to find a way. They're going to leave the island. They're going to use that boat, and they're going to get back to Aslan Tal. And even once again, the children prove their use to Trumpkin Hal.
A compass,
not a compass. They just they remember elements of the coastline that not even the old Narnians know about. Because that whole area has just become kind of a wasteland for so long that they remember stuff about navigating that area that Trumpkin had no idea of.
No.
So already, you know, you're great warriors and you're great archers and you're a great healer and you're great navigators and you know this country even better than I do. And so all the pieces are coming together. The horn has indeed worked. It has brought the children, but they're not just kids anymore.
No.
Even though the outward appearance might still seem very, very young, that Narnian air has been working, and who are these four?
They're the kings and queens of
Narnia. They are the kings and queens of Narnia. Don't you doubt it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Boy, they're reminiscing about their boat.
What was this business about? Do you remember our voyage to Terabithia?
They are, they're recollecting parts of their reign. So in what we read from the first book, we skip over, you know, a decade's worth of their ruling, where lots of stuff happened. And so one of the things that they're now kind of reminiscing, things that we weren't aware of, but kind of makes sense. Like, oh, remember, you know, nobody goes near the water anymore because they're all scared. We had a beautiful boat. Remember when we ventured as far out as the Lone Isles? Remember when we did this? Remember when we did that? And so partly it's to lay little seeds of storyline in your head, like, oh, now you can kind of imagine some of these stories that we were never told. But it's also to kind of re-emphasize that their old lives are now all coming back. So not just old skill, but old memories, old elements of character. They are truly becoming who they were by the time they left Narnia, rather than who they were when they have come back into it. How are we so far? Once again, we start off this book, a couple of you express some doubts, like, it doesn't look like anything's going to happen. What do you think so far?
Good. I think it's good. I didn't like this book when I read it the first time.
Well, you should have.
That's years ago.
It was good then, and it's good now. All right, so no class next week because of Ash Wednesday.
Yeah.
We will pick up after that, and we will we'll be reading chapters 9 and 10.
Yeah. Okay.
All right, we good?
Ooh, the return of the lion.
Okay.